For a document with such an outsized impact on the lives of all Americans, the 2,600-page U.S. tax code is remarkably arcane. But then again, for a country with an economy as large and diverse as the United States, it's hardly a surprise. Tracing back to 1874, the Internal Revenue Code, as it's officially called, has been fully overhauled just a handful of times, in 1939, 1954, and 1986. But in the meantime, its details have been amended and modified in countless ways as the economy has grown, political parties have come in and out of power, and priorities have shifted. Conservatives have been calling for another overhaul to the tax code for years, and now it seems they finally have an opportunity to follow through. But, as always, the devil is in the details. And there are a lot of details. Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and to help us understand some of the nuances of the current reform proposal, we're joined by HKS Professor of Practice Jason Furman, who is President Obama's top economic advisor, serving as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from 2013 to 2017. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The conversation about tax reform, it was kicked off, well, Republicans have been wanting this for a very long time, but really the conversation was kicked off earlier this year when the White House released a outline plan. They called it the Unified Framework for Fixing Our Broken Tax Code. Is our tax code broken?
I think our tax code could certainly be improved. If you asked me to rank my priorities, number one, we should be getting more revenue because we're currently not collecting enough to do what we do as a government. Number two, more progressivity to combat the big rise in inequality we've seen. Number three, more efficiency so the tax code could be more conducive to economic growth and to efficient allocation of resources. Mm-hmm. And number four, the tax code should be simpler. There's a lot of controversy over the level of revenue and the distribution of revenue. So I would settle for making improvements on my priorities number three and four, mm-hmm. efficiency and simplicity, and leaving the debate over revenue and progressivity to another day.
The simplicity piece is particularly interesting because it seems a core part of what we're hearing out of Congress and out of the administration right now. Paul Ryan is famously holding up postcards during his press conferences saying that filing your taxes should be that simple. You just fill out a postcard. Is the hassle of filing taxes really all that big of a problem? And how is this tied to tax cuts?
Right. So I put simplification number four on my list. I think all else being equal, it is better to have a tax system that is simpler. There are ways that we could simplify the tax system. What I think the most important thing to do for simplification would be to do what a lot of other countries do and don't make people fill out the tax return. Have the government fill it out for you. Have them send you a bill. If you want to dispute the bill and fill out the form yourself, you're welcome to, or if you want to just accept the numbers, you can do that as well. So I think that would be what I would do for simplification. If you look at this particular legislation, simplification is a little bit of a red herring for some issues. So for example, this legislation would take us from seven tax rates that we have today to three or four tax rates under the new system. For personal income. The number of tax rates doesn't affect complexity at all. You're just looking it up on a tax table or you're doing TurboTax. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't matter to people. This legislation would modestly simplify for some people because it would raise the standard deduction. And so some people that currently itemize their taxes would instead switch the standard deduction. They wouldn't need to keep track of their mortgage interest, their charitable contributions, their state and local taxes, and other things. So I think it would be a little bit of a simplification, but it wouldn't, for most people, change the complexity of taxes very much. And a lot that's in it has nothing to do with simplification.
I think right now what's been proposed doesn't actually take out the charitable contribution deduction. That it leaves that in place. But I'm curious for your thoughts on what impact that would have if charitable deductions was removed as a way to save on your taxes.
Right. You're right that the legislation maintains the charitable deduction. But right now you have a choice between taking either the standard deduction or getting to list all your expenses and having an itemized deduction. Mm-hmm. What the legislation would do is raise the standard deduction. When it raises the standard deduction, some of the people who currently are itemizing no longer would. So a lot of people would no longer take the charitable deduction. Mm-hmm. And those people's lives would be simpler. You don't need to keep track of what you gave to charity. On the other hand, the tax benefits of going to charity would go down. So if you look at this legislation, it would reduce charitable giving in three ways. One, by expanding the itemized deductions. Two, by cutting tax rates, which gives you less of a tax incentive to give to charity. And three, by eliminating the estate tax, which is a big source of impetus for giving to charity. So I think charity probably should be tax deductible. I think this legislation would hurt charity. I don't think that's one of the biggest issues with it.
I think raising the standard deduction would be a broadly, I think people would enjoy that, more money in your pocket, but that has knock-on effects. What's your take on that?
Right. So the way you want to think about when you have a big complicated set of tax changes like this, you don't want to look at any one change and says that raised taxes or that cuts taxes or that helps the middle class or that hurts the middle class. Because there's a lot of different moving pieces and you want to look at the package as a whole and say, does the package raise taxes or lower taxes? Does the package as a whole help the middle class or hurt the middle class? So the standard deduction, for example, you're right, that's a tax cut. On the other hand, the legislation takes away something called the personal exemption. That's a tax increase. I don't think you want to think of either one of them as a tax cut or a tax increase. Those basically come paired together. So this is a different way of collecting taxes. On that particular trade, the exemption for a credit and the standard deduction could actually be a modest improvement in terms of reducing some tax distortion, simplifying, but that's not a tax cut. It's a reshuffling of the way that we collect taxes.
So after the United Framework or Unified Framework was released, just a couple of weeks ago, a report from the current administration's Council of Economic Advisors, your former council, released a report that you took issue with. You weren't alone in your criticism. Your faculty colleague, Larry Summers, also wrote about it. He called it, in his own inimitable way, dishonest, incompetent, and absurd. Those are very strong words, not to associate them with you, but can you describe your reservations about the administration's claims?
Yeah. No, I disagree with the numbers that the Council of Economic Advisors came out with, and I'm not alone in that. The American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank in Washington, the head of economics there said the numbers were an exaggeration. Those were his words. Two conservative economists in the Wall Street Journal came up with their own numbers, and their own numbers were below the lower bound put out by the Council of Economic Advisors. And I think what the problem that the Council of Economic Advisors had was that they used a cherry-picked set of studies. They used some parts of the studies and not other parts of the study. The studies didn't really apply to the tax change that we're talking about now. But the bigger issue is to step back from all of this and ask the question, will this tax reform be good for the economy, or will it be bad for the economy? If the tax reform is good for the economy, it's probably going to raise wages. If the tax reform is bad for the economy, it's probably going to reduce wages. My own judgment, based on what we've seen so far, and we haven't seen all the details, is it's more likely to be bad for the economy. Mm-hmm. And that's because the extra debt and deficits that it has will outweigh any direct benefits of the tax cuts and leave us worse off over time.
Now, the specific numbers that have been called out are that cutting the corporate tax rate, which is currently at 35%, at least that's the number on the books, would, quote, increase household income in the United States by, in their words, very conservatively, $4,000 annually. So let's get into the corporate tax rate. it's at 35%, but that's not actually what companies pay in terms of what is called the effective tax rate. What would a cut in that rate look like, right, and what would the results be?
Right. So when it comes to business taxation in the United States or corporate taxation in the United States, the problem is not that our corporations are overtaxed. Our corporations are all sorts of ways of not paying taxes. A lot of that is associated with moving money offshore. A bunch of it is associated with using a lot of debt, and investing with debt finance is very attractive in the United States. And so our problem is not that we tax our companies too much. It's that we tax our companies too stupidly. Some of them pay very little in taxes. Some of them actually do pay a lot because they can't take advantage of all those fancy things. Mm-hmm. And that leads to distortions because some companies or activities are taxed heavily. Some are taxed low, and you're spending a lot of time with accountants and you're figuring out the best tax advantage way to do things rather than figuring out the best economic and business thing to do. So, you know, when you conceptualize the problem that way, it becomes not how do we cut taxes for American companies, it's how do we collect those taxes less stupidly. And doing that with a lower rate, a broader base, fewer loopholes would be the way I would do that. But it's really important as part of that to make sure that you're paying for those corporate rate reductions. Because if you're not, one, I think you're misconceptualizing the problem, because the problem is stupid taxation, not overtaxation. Number two, you're proposing a solution that might actually make things worse if they swell the deficit and debt over time.
Mm-hmm. The way that the Council of Economic Advisors has pitched this is that this kind of cut would yield actual wage growth, like direct wage growth between $4,000 and $9,000 per person across the country. Even if we put aside the specific numbers that they've put out in terms of the dollar figure, would a reduction in the corporate tax rate actually yield wage growth?
Oh, I think a well-designed – look, first of all, the corporate tax, the check is written to the government by the treasurer of the corporation. That doesn't mean the corporation paid it. The corporation is going to pass some of those costs on, some to its shareholders, some to its workers. And some of the corporate taxes are definitely paid by workers. Mm-hmm. And lowering corporate taxes in a well-designed way, absolutely, I think it would help raise investment, would help raise the productivity of the investment that we have, and that would translate into higher wages. So I very much believe that corporate taxes are partly paid by workers and sensible reform could raise workers' wages. The question, though, is not the abstract one. It's this particular proposal. What would that do to wages? And to answer that question, you need to look at the proposal as a whole. And it's poorly designed. It has provisions that are phasing in and out, things that are sunsetting, creates new sheltering opportunities for taxes. And most importantly, it increases the deficit. And when you factor all of that in, this is a proposal that I think when the analysts take a hard look at it, they're going to find it lowers economic growth and lowers wages.
We've seen since the 1980s tremendous economic growth, but wage growth hasn't necessarily kept pace. Is there a reason why increasing our economic productivity in this particular way would actually translate to higher wages?
If you look at the wage slowdown since the 1970s, it's actually had two causes. One is the one you are describing, which is an increase in inequality. So workers aren't getting as much of the benefit of economic growth as they used to. But the second is since the 1970s, economic growth has been a lot slower. If you look right now, over the last 5 years, wages have grown at about, real wages at about 1% a year. Productivity has grown at about 1% a year. So right now, people are getting wage increases commensurate with overall economic growth. And we need higher economic growth. We need more productivity growth. Now, I would not say let's make the tax code more regressive in order to get that growth. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't raise, I don't think that growth is so large and so terrific that it would make up for a tax increase on the middle class or a tax increase on the poor. But I do think if we can figure out ways, everything else being equal, to have more productivity growth, I do believe that the preponderance of evidence from looking at across a wide range of countries, looking over a long period of time, is that that would leave people better off.
There's an estimated $2.6 trillion out there in the international community being held by American companies that have decided not to bring that money home because when they do bring it back to the United States, that's when they get taxed. Would this proposal or some proposal to permanently cut the corporate tax rate, would that bring that money home? And would that mean that in the immediate aftermath of such a cut, we'd see, you know, a real boost?
The short answer to your question is absolutely, definitely not. The longer is that your framing of the question repeated a very common misconception, but it actually was wrong. And it's not your fault. Many people make this error. There is $2.6 trillion that is held by the foreign subsidiaries of U.S. corporations. Most of that $2.6 trillion being held by the foreign subsidiaries of U.S. corporations is being held in the United States already. Most of that money is in treasury bonds, mortgage securities, equities, other investments here in the United States already. So if you, quote unquote, allowed the money to come back, as an economic matter, it wouldn't be any more in the United States than it already is. So this is a relabeling. It simplifies some accounting. It solves certain technical issues. I think it actually would have certain minor benefits over the long run that are worth doing for reasons we could talk about. But it's not like $2.6 trillion would come back. Mm-hmm. The other thing to understand is most companies that have money in their foreign subsidiaries also have a ton of money in their U.S. corporations. So you look at Apple, can't remember the numbers anymore, but I think they certainly used to be, and my guess is they still are, they have tens of billions of dollars in their foreign subsidiaries. They have tens of billions of dollars in their U.S. parent also. So if Apple wants to invest more money, they don't need their foreign cash. They have more than enough U.S. cash. And I'm willing to go out on a limb and suggest that the bond market might be willing to lend to Apple at a relatively low rate as well. That I certainly, if they wanted to borrow money from me, would be willing to lend them some at a decent interest rate. So the reason, you know, Apple's not going to invest any more in the United States if you change international tax rules. Apple invests in the United States based on the value proposition of investing in the United States, and these international changes don't change that.
So I gather you wouldn't be a fan of something like the corporate tax holiday that's been floated, where companies have a one-time opportunity to bring back their foreign investments, or I don't know what to call it if not foreign, their foreign domestic investments, and do it at a very low rate in order to spur investment.
Oh, no, repatriation. I had a rule when I was the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors that whenever our staff represented the council in meetings, they had to reiterate that a one-time repatriation tax holiday was the single dumbest public policy idea anyone had ever come up with. Because you give corporations a choice, of course they're going to make choices that reduce their own taxes. Of course we're going to lose money as a result of that, and you're not going to get any extra investment and jobs out of it. Mm-hmm. What I do think is a good idea, and actually is in this bill, is to do a one-time mandatory tax on all the money in foreign subsidiaries. And so, you know, call it a 15% rate. You could argue over what the rate is. And so we're going to tax it once. And then going forward, we're going to have a new set of rules to make sure we don't get into this issue again. So the international system is an example of the broader business tax system, where we create a lot of distortions in technical ways without raising a lot of revenue. So I think we could collect more with less distortions if we did things right with international taxation. And so there's no reason we need to have this overseas problem again, even though it, I think, is a relatively minor problem.
Mm-hmm. You've cited a couple times now the effect of doing these kinds of tax cuts and not paying for them. What is the effect on the overall economy if the federal government were to enact this kind of tax cut and essentially do it as a deficit spending type situation rather than offsetting it with cuts?
The Full consequences, we don't know, because we don't know how the deficit would eventually be paid for. When you cut taxes without cutting spending, you're shifting costs to the future. You're inevitably resulting in future tax increases or future spending cuts or whatever it is. And depending on how that is, that could exacerbate the problems or maybe not. In general, economists have done a range of modeling. And there's a place called the Penn-Wharton budget model that is run by an excellent person named economist named Kent Smetters. And when they've analyzed these types of deficit increasing tax cuts, they've generally found that over the medium and long term, they reduce economic growth because the cost of the tax cut outweighs the benefit of the cost of deficits outweigh any benefit from the tax cut.
The Council of Economic Advisers, the current council, in their report, they did cite a number of studies that have looked at smaller countries, states like North Carolina. But you've said that that's not quite applicable because of the complexity of the U.S. economy. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why is that?
Yeah. Well, look, if a business is deciding whether to invest in Belgium or the Netherlands, and one of them gives you a tax advantage relative to the other, that might be a really good reason to pick the Netherlands over Belgium. The United States, the tax rate here is going to invest it, affect that decision. You know, maybe if you're deciding between the United States and Belgium, the tax rate will matter, but it will be a much smaller factor because you may need to be in the United States for the market, because of the workers you have here, because of supply chains, for all sorts of reasons to be in the United States. So corporate decisions about whether to be in the United States, whether to expand in the United States, are sensitive to taxes. They're just not nearly as sensitive to taxes as, you know, corporate decisions about whether or not to invest in Belgium are.
If I were to sit you down in a room with Paul Ryan today and ask you both to come up with a compromise on tax reform, where are those areas where you would find agreement?
I agreed with the vote Paul Ryan cast a few weeks ago. It was for a budget resolution that would have set up revenue-neutral tax reform. Unfortunately, the Senate passed a budget resolution with a $1.5 trillion tax cut, and now the House went along and passed the tax cut. So as of a few weeks ago, Speaker Ryan was in favor of revenue neutrality, and he has moved off of that. So in some senses, there, you know, I think he agreed with me that if you raise the deficit a lot, you hurt the economy. I don't think he agreed so much with me that he was willing to, you know, go against the White House and the Senate that, and, you know, what he sees, maybe correctly so. I don't know. I'm not a judge of this as a political imperative for the Republican Party. Paul Ryan also had a great idea about tax reform in a white paper he had a few years ago, which was to expand the earned income tax credit for workers without children. This is a way of making it more rewarding to work, bringing people into the workforce, many of them, many of them men without children. Unfortunately, that idea stayed in the white paper and didn't make it into this particular piece of legislation. So another thing I'd say is, why not take some of the good ideas you've actually had in the past and make sure they're here too?
Well, Professor, I really, really appreciate your coming on today, and I hope it all turns out well.
Thanks so much for having me and for this very rational discussion about a issue that is more emotionally charged for people than it should be.
Well, you know how numbers can get. It's. PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm Matt Cadwallader. That's at Matt Cad on Twitter. My co-producers are Natalie Montaner, Sarah Abrams, and Becky Wickel. Have something to tell us about this or any other episode? Let us know on Twitter at PolicyCast or via email at policycast@hks.harvard.edu. And visit us at hkspolicycast.org. See you next week.